Welcome to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Gabriel Kolko. Gabriel is a leading historian, scholar, and activist, and he's Toronto's York University Distinguished Research Professor Emeritus. He's written many, many articles, 14 books, including The Age of War, The United States Confronts the World, Century of War, Politics, Conflicts, and Society Since 1914, and his newest that we talked about the last time he was on the program, World in Crisis, The End of the American Century. Gabriel, I welcome you. Oh, we're still working. Well, we gotta go a little ways to find him. Gabriel is a very distinguished historian, especially the very extensive accounts of war that he's written about. He wrote the definitive work on the Vietnam War, very, very long in detail. I've got a number of his books on my shelf that I've read over the years, and he's truly an important man discussing about the important issues of our time. Last time, one of the points he made in his newest book, The End of the American Century, subtitle, it really struck me that his view is the decline of this country began at the time of the Korean War. Now think about that. That was 1950 to 1953. So we're talking... Have you got him?
Yes.
Gabriel, oh, welcome.
She
welcome.
Has me.
I gave you a rousing introduction.
I'm glad to be here.
Oh, I'm delighted to have you back. I'll refresh your memory a little bit. We have a few commercial breaks, one coming up at 4 minutes after the hour, then three more, but we have a lot of time to talk about issues. And you mentioned to me in an email when we got together in arranging this date that you look at the situation as being very complex, and I'm very eager to hear your views. It's not a pretty situation, and I certainly look at it all the time, and so do you. Let me let you begin with your thoughts, and after the break, first break, we'll come back and pick it up.
Okay, thank you. You want a break now?
Oh, no. When the music comes on in about 1 minute, we'll take a break. That's the cue that they're coming up to a break. So I will interrupt at that point. But let me let you begin briefly.
Well, as I told you before, I think the world is becoming increasingly complex. And with the demise of the Soviet communist menace, the United States has become far less focused on its real enemy. You know, the war in Afghanistan is now over 8 years old, and it began as a war against al-Qaeda, and now it's a war against the Taliban. And so to speak, the Pentagon is spending a tremendous amount of money, $700 billion in the next budget directly, almost $300 billion indirectly. But they're lashing out at an unknown enemy. And that enemy, of course, is an enemy of choice. There's Muslim fundamentalism, which the United States supported against the communists. And there are enemies all over. There's terrorists, etc. And the United States lacks, in the post-communist world, a focus.
Let me interrupt you, Gabriel. Please hold that thought and pick it up when we come back. And when we don't have enemies, we can easily invent them as we do all the time. Let's take a break. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Talking about wars that seem to go on forever, and when one abates, something else begins. But Gabriel, you made the point that the Afghan one has been going on for 8 years, and, of course, the Iraq one. I suspect it ebbs and flows, but we don't get too many reports over here about the daily car bombs that go off and the killings. The bad ones get reported, but if something happens that apparently the major media here don't feel merits their level of importance, they simply ignore it. People are dying every day in Iraq, and of course Afghanistan is a raging war. And one more point also, we may do well on an open battlefield one-on-one against another armed force, but we don't do too well against guerrilla forces. But you're an expert on that, not me.
The United States has inherited, really, the outcome of the First World War, the settlements reached after the First World War and before the First World War, too, created Iraq and Afghanistan out of an arbitrary collection of tribes. Afghanistan is everything. It's Uzbek, it's Pashtun, it's Tajik, it's tribes of every sort in nature, and the same back. So in a sense, these are not countries. These are entities drawn arbitrarily, and of course they have a fantastic political problem, all based, of course, on nationalism. I mean, the Kurds are nationalists. And the Kurds exist in Iran and Iraq and Turkey and Syria, etc. So that the United States is trying to patch up something which can't be patched up, and no amount of firepower, and the United States wins all of its battles, will solve the political problem. And the political problem is essentially that Iraq and Afghanistan are not really countries. They're entities, but they're not countries. Essentially, these are tribal societies. In this regard, the Undersecretary of State under Bush, Richard Armitage, gave an interview, and he said, look, our policy is amoral. We try to work with tribes. We try to buy people. We throw money around. But it simply doesn't work. He gave an interview at the end of last year, and essentially the United States is throwing money after lost causes. And Afghanistan and Iraq are militarily, certainly in Iraq, victories, but politically, total failures.
It really is shocking in the amount of money that we spend on this that is really draining us and piling up an unrepayable national debt, Gabriel, plus all of the other obligations that we have since the financial crisis, the economic crisis broke it in late 2007.
The net effect of that debt is that many countries are starting to go off the dollar as a reserve currency. They're looking for other kinds of currencies to buy, and this has made the European Union much more attractive, and countries are beginning to diversify. And, of course, economic power is no longer a monopoly of the United States, as it was after the Second World War. You have India and China, and China's coming along very, very quickly in a form of Leninist communism, Leninist capitalism, I should say. And India and Russia are developing, and Brazil are developing very quickly. And so what is happening after spending so much money on these futile wars is that the dollar is beginning to weaken. And China is becoming much stronger, relatively speaking, relative to the United States. And this is happening across the board. And it's counterproductive what the United States is doing militarily. It's not working politically, and it's not working economically. Economically, of course, the world is far more complex than it ever was. And we've just passed through the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression of the 1930s. We're not out of it yet.
Well, I don't think we're out of it at all. And I have a number of programs with economists who really explain things honestly. And they paint a very, very dark picture of what they see coming up. Michael Hudson, for one, he talks about the issue of debt. He talks about the debt burden being so unmanageable, impossible to repay, and yet our solution seems to be to pile on incredible more amounts of debt that make it even more impossible to repay. I mean, there's got to be a bad ending to this somewhere, but nobody knows exactly when or how, but when it comes, it may be thunderous. By the way, the dollar in recent months has staged a rebound, I guess just like the stock market did through most of last year. One reason being because the European countries, Western European countries, are in an awful lot of trouble. So you've got the EU, Gabriel, and the euro, and you've got countries like Spain and Greece and Ireland, not to mention Eastern Europe, not part of the euro system. But, I mean, terrible, terrible problems. And so it's maybe the dollar temporarily is the best of the worst. But Asia seems to be the rising part of the world, China for sure, and India, and Brazil, of course, the major country in South America. And I can't imagine why these countries would not want to make a break. I guess they have to do it very carefully, but in some way make a break from the system we're under, the dollar and whatever. There really is a road to nowhere, and I guess very gingerly they try to become marginally more independent, and yet if they try to do it too much, they run into our ire, which means they can become a military target. Oh, it's a very nasty situation.
Well, it's complex, and I don't know what's going to happen next, but neither the people who have the nominal power to control the situation. The World Bank, in any event, is extremely pessimistic, and they think that it's still a very dangerous situation. And, of course, the Bank for International Settlements of the World Bank, the IMF, warned well before the subprime crisis that a crisis was inevitable. The world economy has become far, far, far too complex. And no one, including the people in power, quite understand it. The new ways of accounting, there's a very good book by translated from French by a man named Véron, which shows that their ingenious systems of concealing losses and making profits. And in this context, the foreign policy running up debt is building towards a disaster, and where it ends, no one knows. It may be solved, but it may not be solved, and this is the dilemma that Obama has. In any event, the only consensus he can get from Congress is the consensus to spend more money on war, rather than his domestic program, which, of course, is how he came to power. And under the circumstances, we live in an era of tremendous flux and rapid change. And while there are glooms on the horizon, there are also dangers which can't be calculated.
But it seems that there's no question that Obama came into office to continue the Bush administration policies. He certainly has done that, and now after an electoral defeat in the special election of Massachusetts, very ironic, I think, Gabriel, the idea that a no-name Republican, who certainly is far to the right of center, won the seat that Ted Kennedy held for half a century or so. Not that Kennedy was a shining example of the best liberal in Congress, but compared to most Republicans, he certainly was. He also supported...
Well,
Go ahead.
Yes, but functionally, Obama is pursuing essentially George Bush's foreign policy. I mean, he's escalating in Afghanistan. He is maintaining the war in Iraq. He wants to reduce troops in Iraq, but he wants to send them to Afghanistan, which is just a losing proposition. He's been warned by Zygmunt Brzezinski, who was Carter's national security advisor, that the United States is going to go the way of the Soviets if they continue this. Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, says the United States presence will be required for another 15, 20 years. Well, it's simply not going to happen. No one will have another 15, 20 years. The history of American foreign policy isn't like that. In Korea, the Democrats were defeated in 1952 simply because Eisenhower promised peace. And he said he had a method. And Nixon, of course, defeated Johnson because he said he had a plan for victory in Vietnam. And under the circumstances, the United States is getting deeper and deeper into a quagmire. I hear music in the background. I think you want
to... Yeah, we need to take another break. We'll pick up on that as soon as we come back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back on with Gabriel Colco, discussing what I would call, Gabriel, this country's permanent war agenda, and that certainly it doesn't matter whether we have a George Bush doing it or a Barack Obama. My God, we had a Lyndon Johnson and a Richard Nixon, and Reagan did it mostly with proxies, except for Grenada, I guess, entirely with proxies, Central America and other places. Clinton had his Yugoslavia war. I mean, it just goes on and on and on endlessly. Senior Bush, Noriega in Panama, and the Gulf War. And we have two more now under Obama. Obama has a new front in Yemen, and for that strategic part of the world and the waterways and so on. And now Haiti is an occupied country. 20,000 U.S. forces. Paratroopers, Marines, naval vessels offshore, and I wrote a number of articles since the Haitian earthquake, Gabriel, and I learned one thing that really amazed me. I never knew it before, but Haiti is a potentially very rich country resource-wise, especially the most important resource, oil, and I guess where there's oil is always gas, but offshore, off the southern shore of Haiti, there is a potential treasure trove of oil, and apparently this has been known about for a long time, but when you don't need it, you keep it hush-hush. But why on earth would 20,000 of our forces be in Haiti, probably for an extended period? It certainly isn't because of the earthquake. It's got to be for another reason, and I would imagine it's to get as many of those Haitians out of the way so we can begin whatever we want to do to develop those resources.
Well, the Haitians can't leave and go to Florida, which many have tried to do, and the U.S. Coast Guard has a blockade up to keep the Haitians in Haiti. But let me change the subject a little to tell you to discuss how complex the world is. You have the whole problem of intelligence. You have the National Security Agency, which spends more money than all the intelligence agencies put together, the CIA, and the whole intelligence apparatus. The NSA, and this is the subject of several books that have come out recently, Bamford and Abe, the NSA simply doesn't operate when it has an electrical shortage. When it has an electrical shortage, all of its computers and satellites and electrical listening equipment, and it gets millions and millions of calls every day, just simply break down. and they simply don't know what to do. And many, of course, of these conversations are in foreign languages, and either the NSA or the CIA have the personnel or the technique or the equipment to translate millions and millions of messages which arrive automatically in languages other than English, so that really the whole intelligence system doesn't work too well, if it works at all. But the other thing is that the CIA has, and these are not very many, but they have some very able people who are very, very pessimistic about the long-range future of U.S. power. And the National Intelligence Council has been warning the entire Washington establishment that in the long run, the United States is just one country of many, and American power is limited. And, of course, no one is listening to the National Intelligence Council, even though this stuff is actually very, very good, very acute. They're interested in the limits of U.S. power. And those limits were shown in Korea, they were shown in Vietnam, and they've been shown now in Afghanistan and other places. And under the circumstances, the United States is quixotically trying to fight a fight which can't be fought by any nation, I mean, whether the United States or the Soviet Union or England or France or anybody. And I'm afraid they learned very slowly, and this is a serious, serious problem. But the American public is being alienated by the Afghan war. They're turning against it slowly but surely. And under the circumstances, given the fact that there are elections, it will probably be politically decisive for politicians to say, I'm against the wars that exist, and of course there would vote that way, and they'll be elected to office. And the same thing is likely to happen in this context of Afghanistan and Iraq and Yemen and Haiti, as happened with the Vietnam War. Eventually the public will turn against it, and when that happens, of course, the politicians will follow suit.
There was a great deal of opposition two, 3 years ago. I forget the exact time frame, Gabriel, but at one point there was a lot of opposition, I think, when Iraq was particularly hot and Afghanistan was not as hot as it is now. But that subsided. I was very disappointed about that. Back, you remember, the 1960s and 70s. I mean, there was extreme opposition to the Vietnam War. And even in the military itself, of course, we had a draft back then. We have to take another break. But I think, you can speak to this. I think it got the military very worried that they just couldn't go on like this, so there could be a rebellion. Let's take a break. We'll come right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
I'm with Gabriel Coco talking about the war situation, the wars that America fosters, and the terrible problems that result from them. Gabriel, it seems that, I mean, they go on endlessly. Wasn't there a major problem during the Vietnam years, late 1960s, early 1970s, where the military was very worried just exactly whether they could hold everything together.
Well, there are people within the military and within Washington establishment who are very alienated by the process. I would say there is not so much a process of radicalization, because these people are not radicals, but there is a process of alienation. And there are many, many generals who say the wars are counterproductive, the former head of intelligence in Afghanistan, a man, I have his name here, Major General who was in charge of the intelligence in Afghanistan, says the U.S. Record in Afghanistan is dismal, and that it's ignorant of local customs. Excuse me. And it's simply counterproductive. And under the circumstances, there are many, many people in Washington, very many officials, who see this as a dead end, and they want to tailor policy to fit reality and American resources. And so there is a process now whereby many of these individuals are speaking out, and it's very, very useful. On the other hand, they don't have a real access to people of great power. And if you want to get ahead, you say whatever is necessary to get ahead, and you don't question the fundamentals of the system. But there are people who are very, very alienated now. And this is a new factor, perhaps more than during the Vietnam War. And during the Vietnam War, there were many, many officers who said, look, we're never going to Vietnamese the war. The Vietnamese army, the Saigon army, is basically corrupt. And many people are saying this now about Afghanistan. In the case of Afghanistan, most of the Afghan police force is illiterate. About one-fifth are drug addicts, and they're corrupt. And under the circumstances, they're not effective. And there are people now who are in official circles who are complaining about this. It's simply not going to work.
Here, and I don't know how the European media is, Gabriel, but the major media here, these voices, these people that you talk about, and it's been a while, but I've quoted some military people, some generals or some admirals, people who diverge from the customary view that I guess everybody is supposed to take. These people never show up in the media here. So the little media monitoring I do, which I need to just to keep up on what they're doing, so I can see how outrageous it is, and a little media critique that I do from time to time, you still get voices going in one direction. You don't hear negative comments about Iraq or Afghanistan or any of the warlike activities this country engages in. My memory is foggy.
The only paper I read, actually, in paper form is the Financial Times of London. And the Financial Times is quite good. The top intelligence officer I'm referring to is a man named Michael Flynn, and he thinks that the Americans, in terms of Afghanistan, are, what is, to quote him, clueless, dismal, etc. So the news coverage is not as bad as it could be. It's just that it has no great influence. Afghanistan is a losing proposition. It's been a losing proposition for 2,000 years, and anyone who's ever seen it says you have to be absolutely insane to go in to fight in that country, especially with high technology, because the only thing that can get around Afghanistan are mules and donkeys. And under the circumstances, there's probably more opposition now among the military than there's ever been, and many of them are speaking out. There's quite a group of them. And the same is true of the CIA, of course. There are a lot of people in the CIA, but there was during the Vietnam War also. During the Vietnam War, they had a very, very acute insight into what was the problem and the limits of American power. And no one simply paid any attention to that. The man who said, look, you're making a great big mistake about the size of the Viet Cong. They're much larger than you think so, was simply ignored. And, of course, he was eventually sued by Westmoreland, who was American commander-in-chief, for saying that Westmoreland covered the real statistics, which he did cover up. And, in fact, the case was settled out of court. Westmoreland never made his point. The fact is that no one likes bad news, and they're getting a lot of bad news, and they're getting it from fairly well-informed people.
In the One question, Gabriel. In the mid-1960s, didn't Defense Secretary Robert McNamara tell Lyndon Johnson that the Vietnam War was unwinnable? And yet it went on all those succeeding years. I think another important issue is that you don't necessarily want to fight all these wars to win them. You fight them to keep on fighting them because it's so profitable, not just for the defense industries, but for all of the related industries to defense. They make so much money, they simply don't want to stop fighting wars. And if something dies down, they want to crank up another one to make all this more money.
Well, that's part of the picture, but only a part. The other factor is credibility. The United States doesn't like to lose wars, and one of the reasons they hung on as long as they did in Vietnam, because they weren't winning there, was credibility. And that can't be minimized. The United States, once it's in a war, doesn't like to lose it. Because then they look like a weak power. And this factor of credibility was extremely important in Vietnam. And McNamara's actual role in Vietnam was very ambiguous. On the other hand, he also spent much more money on the war than he should have, and he helped Lyndon Johnson continue long after he knew better. His children, of course, were very different. He was very influenced by them, and that's part of the picture too. But under the circumstances, the United States has a losing proposition in Afghanistan. And although in military terms they won the war in Iraq, there's no question about it. In political terms, they'll be there for an indefinite period of time. And they'll probably be driven out because the majority of the people don't want them.
But I guess what can turn out even to be a military victory can turn out at some later time to be another defeat. We certainly haven't won a resounding victory since World War II. Korea, bad. Vietnam, bad. The Gulf War, well, it's hard even to call it a war. It just went on for a few weeks. But then we had the decade of the 90s and then another Iraq war, now the occupation. But the Iraqis are very upset that we're there. So the killing goes on. So I expect that could get a lot hotter at some point in the future. And Afghanistan may be the biggest mess of all. I mean, just the geography, the size and the geography of that place, Gabriel, makes it not exactly the most desirable country to want to fight a war in.
I've seen Afghanistan, and it's nothing but mountains. It's up and down. But the problem, of course, for the United States, apart from the fact that they sell equipment and the defense budget is a very important prop in the economy, is the fact that it's a certain mentality. They don't like to lose wars, and once they get into a war, the question of credibility becomes very important. Now, the present defense strategy is that they want to fight two major wars simultaneously. They want to win two wars simultaneously, but they simply can't do so. They can't win one war, much less two. and under the circumstances, it's a losing proposition. Cuba, nominally communist, I don't know what it is, or North Korea, nominally communist, and it certainly is a Confucian society, if it's anything, still communist, and under the circumstances, the United States is beating its head against a wall. And it's simply going to have to learn how to live like any other country, which is accept reality, because reality is not going to change. And it must, above all, accept the fact that people are nationalists. The Taliban was not originally America's enemy. America worked with the Taliban, gave them arms to fight the Soviet Union. But they aren't nationalists, and under the circumstances, they want foreign invaders out, not just Americans, but any foreign invader. I'm afraid the United States is trying to fight reality, and the reality world is it's far too complex for any one country to control, the United States included.
And at the same time, we maintain this enormous network of bases around the world, besides all the ones in the U.S., bases, nobody knows the exact number, but Chalmers Johnson thinks it may be around 1,000. And if I remember the number, 1,000 sounds like a reasonable number.
But, that's a good estimate. There are bases all over, and every time you try to close one, you get an uproar in the local community because bases provide employment, they provide work, and they provide the local infrastructure things to do. But that's simply the case all over. I mean, if you go to northern France, there are many French communities who live on bases too. And one of the regrets that we encountered when we traveled there was that the people complained that a base was closing down and this was affecting the local economy. But for the United States, it's more important because they do have so many bases, and the bases are extremely important political factor. And congressmen are often elected simply because they get money from the Pentagon for their constituency. And this is a factor also in keeping the Pentagon budget right up there. And it's now indirectly and directly approaching $1 trillion a year. And it's a stupendous amount of money because there are a lot of things you can do with $1 trillion.
Oh, they sure are. Well, we could simply give another trillion to the bankers, Gabriel. We've given them untold trillions up to now. A trillion here, a trillion there. Sooner or later, we're talking about real money. To paraphrase that old line that from the man, the senator you and I remember well. Seems to me I heard him say it a few times, Everett Dirksen, speaking about billions. Well, now it's trillions.
Nomi Prince.
Yes.
Has written a book, and she estimates the number of subventions of American banks by the American government to come to about $13 trillion. And that's a tremendous sum of money. A trillion is still a lot of money. And she estimates the handouts to the various banks. In various forms, they have repaid some of it, about $13 trillion.
Well, it's even worse than that. This man, Neil Barofsky, the man who is the administrator of the TOP program, which is only $700 billion, or at least nominally $700 billion, I've heard him say that we have pledged, how much they've gotten, maybe half this amount, but he said, we have pledged $23.7 trillion to these bankers. I mean, that's incomprehensible to me. And, of course, we know that the Federal Reserve, which, of course, is a private banking cartel, has handed out all kinds of amounts of money to their banking community. And they won't say how much. They won't say how much to whom. It's all secret. Apparently, there's some effort being made to get hold of their records or their emails or whatever, but they've resisted, and so far we don't have it. So who knows how much money the bankers have, or how much more they'll be given if they simply ask for it.
Well, Hank Paulson, who one of the people in charge of this, has just published a memoir, which is very, very sensational. But the United States was confronted with a financial meltdown, and things could have been as bad as the Great Depression. And the state simply decided to step in, according to him, and save the banks from failing. The consequences of not doing so would have been so horrendous because the financial system was coming apart a year ago, a year and a half ago. And one of the reasons it's come together lately is that they've gotten tremendous federal subsidies. Now, this is socialism for the rich, not for the poor. And that, of course, is not going to be politically popular. And Obama will have to face the fact that he's keeping the bankers afloat at a time that he doesn't have a consensus to pass his health insurance bill or do all the things he promised.
Well, indeed, so. And, of course, Paulson, former Goldman Sachs, Treasury Secretary under Bush, and, of course, he's speaking as a banker, Gabriel. He's not speaking as one of us. Anyway, we'll take another break. Another break, and we'll come back, and I'll let you finish up.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. Final segment with Gabriel Kolko. Gabriel, other economists on this, I guess, on this program have said, indeed, as you said, we had a major, major economic problem. Their view is that we haven't really solved that problem. We have simply tucked it under the rug and pushed back likely an even greater one down the line because of the policies that have been adopted. And a much sounder one, at least on an interim basis, would have been to take these insolvent banks and nationalize them instead of handing over all these trillions of dollars to them. And they haven't used those trillions of dollars to improve the economy. They've used them to speculate and work on the next bubble. Credit has been contracting continually since this began because they will not lend. So they haven't exactly found the winning formula to get the economy back on an even keel. And the conclusion of these people who come on my program are, there is a serious day of reckoning ahead, and it's going to be pretty ugly when it arrives.
Well, there are a lot of people who are extremely well-informed who are terribly worried. And the most important, of course, are around the IMF and the World Bank. And in large, fairly respectable organizations, not just radicals are worried, but anyone who is knowledgeable. The problem is that you have such a complex financial system. It's so interlocked in certain ways that anything that goes wrong has large manifestations. And the subprime contract began with $20-30 billion in subprime, and it ended up affecting trillions. And the element of confidence is very, very important. And when people lose that element, then the economy goes, well, belly up. It happened before, and it's likely to happen again. In any event, the economy is so complex. It's so convoluted that no one quite understands it. Now, that's not a serious problem for you or me, but it is a serious problem for the people who run things, and they don't quite understand either. People like Paulson try to work around the edges and guide their, et cetera, but it simply is not likely to succeed anymore in the future than it has in the past. The economy is becoming much more complex than ever. And that's a problem that they confront, and it's a problem, of course, that the average person confronts too. Unemployment is going up in the United States, and things are simply not working the way they should. So while we seem to be out of the woods a bit, the fact is that it could all become very, very negative again and defeat the rosiness which now is starting to reappear of the system. It's not rosy at all. It's complex. It's much too complex for security. People simply don't know what's going to happen. It might be optimistic, things might work out, but they might not. And if they don't, then it has untold consequences because it's far more serious. There are many more players in the field. There are now the sovereign wealth funds. There are Russia and the gas producers. There's China, et cetera, et cetera. And under the circumstances...
I'm going to cut you off, Gabriel. That music means they're going to cut me off, so I need to say thank you to you. It's been a wonderful hour. It's a big story. It never ends, and I wish we could continue it. Hopefully we'll be able to. My great thanks, Gabriel, for coming on.
Well, thank you.
And join us again tomorrow.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.